My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic. It's late. Everybody's ready to go. I was back there getting some tea, and it was a couple of ladies walking, and one of them was saying, man, I'm ready to go. And one of them said, it's two more hours. And one said, what? Two more hours? Yeah, they got two more speakers. And I was like, ooh, you know, So I get it. But it's amazing, right? It's Saturday. I got money. Edward, if you're sitting here wondering, when is the miracle going to happen for me? If you're sitting in a room on a Saturday night with money in your pocket in an upright position, you're sitting in the middle of the spiritual experience right now. Right now. A couple of things happens for me, and I was thinking about that. Thank you, Kevin, for picking me up. Kevin came out. My flight was delayed. I was, you know, I got here at 11:30 on a Friday night. It's a member that doesn't even know this guy yet, and he takes out of his time people like us, selfish, self-centered. You know, if I'm doing anything on Friday night, I'm piecing up on something, and somebody's going out to cop, and that's what I'll do. That's the any lengths I'll go to. But for a guy to come out, and I called him, I said, look, my flight is delayed an hour. I was supposed to get in at 10:30. I got in 11:30. He didn't trip. He didn't be like, damn, man. He didn't. And showed up doing what we do. You know what? We've been here all day. It's something about pockets of enthusiasm. Why do we talk about that? I've been around on this planet. Now I guess I'm probably in the fourth quarter, you guys, even though that's hard to say, because my mom is here and she's 94. So maybe I'm only in the third quarter, right? But I don't know. I'm 70 years old, you know, so I'm that's optimistic saying, but I'm probably in the fourth quarter. And if you anything like me, and the reason we come and recharge at events like this, if you're anything like me and you get in real life, right? Life is big. You know, life gets big on a guy named Ralph. You know, when you grown, you have to be grown every day. You know, when you a kid, 18, you know, 16, I can't wait to be grown, you know, and can't nobody tell me what. But you don't know, when you grown, you can't go back to them days when you were, right? Youth is wasted on the young. That's what they say. So you can't wait. But when you grown, you got to be grown every day. And the years come, and the responsibilities come, and they start sending envelopes to the house, and they want you to send something back when they send them, and you know, and right now, if I get by myself too long, and I get away from you guys too long, life has a couple of things that tend to happen to a guy like me. I either get beat up. Anybody ever feel like they get beat up by life sometimes? Like you just want to lay down. Like, man, what's going on? What is it about anyway? You know, you want to roll up. So I feel like it's either one or two things that's happening with me. It's not staying static. I'm either getting beat up or I'm getting lit up. I tend to get beat up by myself. But we, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know something. We know something about recharging. We know something about when one of us gets together, when two or more of us are gathered, the math in the spiritual plane ain't the same as the material. In the spiritual, one in the material, one and one makes two. But in the spiritual, how many people in here sponsor people, right? In the spiritual world, sponsor and sponsee, something else is present and takes place in the equation, right? And the miracle of that kind of alchemy is when one drunk is sharing with another, it ain't one plus one. Seem like God gets up in there. How many times have you heard something come out of your mouth that you didn't know was in your mouth? And it only seems to happen when I'm out of me and I'm in you. You know, it only seems that kind of spiritual alchemy that takes place. One drunk sharing with another. I really don't know what we're going to do. You know, there was a question on the table earlier from the Q&A. Why is there so much God in AA? I'm going to submit to the new person that might have asked that question. There's a whole lot of God in AA because there's a whole lot of alcoholics in AA. And there needs to be a whole lot of God to cover up. And it's enough God. It's enough God. If you just now joining us and you wondering, is there anything still left for me? It's enough God. If you just coming up in here and you listen and you heard Jason and then you sat up here and then you had to go and you went to Massoon, you know, why am I? Oh, thank you for having the thing here. I'm 70. I'm old. You know, you listen to Jason. And you be thinking, ooh, God had, he running on, he working with Jason. And then you run Julie out here, the goth girl, bad girl, you just showing her at from an early age. You know, I know God ain't got nothing left after that. And then Massoon shows up, right? Angry chick, come up here, she don't even know how to speak English till she get drunk, you know. And Doug, you ain't exempt. You know, after Doug, you know God gotta be running on empty. But to the person who wrote that, why is there so much God in AA? It's enough God for you. Franklin Williams, never met him, used to call himself the Pope AA. Listen to some old tapes of his. And Franklin Williams used to say, I can run out of friends. I can run out of money. I might even run out of hope. He said, but I can't run out of God. When you're at the end of it, don't you feel like that? I'm run out of, but I can't. Not I won't. I cannot. And I ain't saying it because Franklin Williams said it. I'm saying it because I've been on this path now for 37 plus years. And more than half my life. And I seem to be at my very best when I'm at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I seem to draw on something that I don't draw on by myself. You know, sometimes, especially when you get a significant other, you know, and they, you get home and they be like, I wish them people at the meetings could see you now. You know, now I might have said it about somebody. He ain't talking like, he ain't walking like he talked, you know. Guilty. Guilty. You had a lot of people come up to this podium this weekend. I'm not going to speak on their behalf, but I kind of want to say it, at least for me. No, I don't walk like I talk. I talk like I'm trying to walk. I talk like I want to walk. I talk like I'm expecting what Alcoholics Anonymous expects, the very best of Ralph White. And I talk like what I'm aiming for, you know. And you guys, you brought that up. So I don't know, you know, I guess I should be coming up here telling you my story. You know, I grew up in Watts in the 60s. I'm one of six boys. And my old man was an alcoholic. And my earliest memory of him was I didn't want to be like him. He wasn't abusive and he wasn't violent. My father was an absentee drunk. And he got put out when I was 8 or 9 years old. And my mom started raising these six boys by herself. You know, I'm not going to go deep in my story, but I'm going to give you a baseline. You know, so I grew up in Watts in the 60s. And I'm from a tough town, but I'm not a tough guy. You know, I listen to some of these ladies. So I was like, damn, I'm this hard guy from my, but I'm scared of Julie. Oh, my God. You know. And because I'm a schoolboy, I'm a square guy, I'm a shy guy, I'm a bookworm, I'm that guy, you know. So I grew up with a mom that was on welfare in the 60s. My mom was a domestic. You know, I grew up, and Jason thought he was dating himself when he was talking about happy days. I grew up on Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, you know, Donna Reed, Ozzie and Harriet, you know. That's the TV programs of my day, and if you came to my house, that was not jumping off in my house. You know, when you get grown, you get something like this, you know. You had a mom that sacrificed everything she had for her boys. My mom was a domestic. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her six boys. But when you were a kid, about 8 or 9 years old, and you coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon, and you got a couple of partners with you, and you hit the front door, and mom's is in the living room with ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in the prison I've lived in much of my life. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll whine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. So I'm growing up like that, and if you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear a couple of common themes from our members. And one of the themes that you'll hear from most of our members is, I never felt like I fit in, and that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy, I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and accomplished a couple of things coming up in life. I'm not going to leave my mom's story dangling like that, because much of what it is that I used to kind of take credit for, it's the way I'm built. You know, and much of that I attribute to my mom, who's still the greatest spiritual example I have in my life. So my mom is this lady. I used to sit at the bus stop with her, waiting on her to come home. She'd catch three buses to the valley where Doug talked about he was living. And maybe working for Doug's parents. I don't know, you know, but let me look at him and see if I want to get a resentment. You know, but my mama was... because she was cleaning people's houses. And at a certain point, she stopped coming home on the bus because my mom went back to adult school and got her GED. Then she went to Trade Tech Junior College. Then she went to Cal State LA. And she graduated from Cal State LA as the same year as my younger brother Ryan graduated from Loyola. And my mom went on to have a long and distinguished career in the insurance field. And so I had a kind of mom that modeled for me that you can do and be whatever it is that you can do and be. You know, and that's how I've always grown up, you know. I grew up in Watts in the city. You needed to grow up in the 60s. You know, if you didn't grow up in the 60s, you missed it. You know, the 60s and the 70s, it was a hot, optimistic time, right? It was a promising time. It was a time of hope, and it was a time of, you know, and I grew up, and I'm that guy. I listened to our other speakers, and Jason was talking about being the, you know, the kid that was the child of hippies. That was, you know, I probably ran with your parents, you know, and, you know, because that was the era I grew up in. I'm glad I grew up in the era I grew up. No disrespect to our young friends. I don't mean new friends. I'm glad I grew up in the era I grew up, you know, because in the late 60s, early 70s, free love, free sex, free drugs, you know, I would go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next, I don't need to know your last name. I don't want to know your sign. I don't need to know your mind. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Are you getting down like I'm getting down? You know, and that's just the way that it was. So, you know, I'm growing up, but I'm green, you know. So I don't take my first drink, you guys. I started probably at 16 or 17. You know, I take some drinks at parties I'm going to, you know, where youngsters are. But I start drinking in earnest in the year of 1971 when I went off to school. I go off to UCLA, and I'm living in the dorms. I'm 18 years old. I'm grown. I'm that stupid grown, the grown where I'll eat cake for dinner if I want to. You know, stupid grown like that, you know. And when you go off to that university in particular, in 1971, you know, I'm living in the dorms, and I'm late to the party. But by the time I get there, it's on. Unlike the previous speakers, I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand when we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's how it showed up in my experience at CREP. I'm drinking, you know, Yago, you know, Spinata, Tyrolean, Annie Green Springs, you know, rum and coke. You know, I'm drinking what youngsters drink, and smoking commercial weed, you know, and it's 1971. You know, I'm listening to some Marvin and some Earth, Wind and Fire on a sunny day, and we going to concerts, and I'm just, and who wouldn't want to be 18 years old in Los Angeles, California, at a major university with his life in front of him? You know, I came to the program four times before I came to stay. My early efforts at doing this deal, I would always compare and I would never identify. I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. I read Bill's story. First thing I say, Bill is an older white guy. We ain't got that in common, you know. Bill was a veteran of foreign wars, Vietnam era draft dodger. Bill and his, you know, Bill and his story would talk about there had been no real infidelity. Miss me on that one too, you know. So when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, somebody taught me how to read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is the way that you listen to our members share at the meetings. When you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, or when you listen to our members share their experience, strength, and hope, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in the light of those questions, when I came back to stay, I found my story. In 1971, just like Bill, I had arrived. You know, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. Just like him, drink started taking a more important and exhilarating part in my life. You know, I'm on a rocket, man, and you couldn't have told me. You couldn't have told me back in 1971 when it was work, because I'm a weekend warrior. I'm drinking on the weekends when I got out of class, you know, and I'm drinking, and it was exciting times, and I'm quasi-grown, and some stuff was really interesting. I'm learning how to mix drink. First, I go with the basics, you know, screwdriver, rum and coke. You know, you start experimenting, going with some tequila sunrise. Oh, that's you know, that's some Jose and some grenadine. And you might put a little, you know, roses lime juice up in there and some, you know, and the orange juice. And you got proud of the fact you were mixing. I'm a bachelor, so now I'm starting making some fruity daiquiris for you, girl, you know. And I'm thinking I'm grown, you know, the kind of stuff you see on TV. And now I start the clubbing, you know, and ordering Manhattans and Long Islands, you know. But you know, in the year 71, man, it was fun and games. You know, and it's all fun and games till somebody get their eye poked out. And, you know, that definitely happened later on. But so 71, I'm drinking on the weekends. Pretty soon, the weekends started starting on Thursday and started ending on Monday. And by the end of my freshman year, I'm drinking and I'm smoking this commercial every day. The book talks about the alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. And even though I'm late to the party, I took to it, man, like a duck to water. And let me give you this real quick vignette. And it's just, it's an illustration that is the best illustration I know of the alcoholic life becoming the only normal. When I'm 16 years old, I had a goal. I'm going to be the first black president of the United States. This is the 60s. And it was an optimistic time. It was a time of hope. And it was and I'm a high achieving guy. And in my community and people who were, you know, because I'm leadership camps and people would encourage it. Dude, that probably ain't going to happen, but it's a lofty goal to aim for. And look where you'll probably end up. You know, I thought I was going to end up in politics doing some work. But that's, hold on to that. 16 years old, my goal is to be the first black president of the United States. I'm 18 years old now. I'm a freshman. And I'm 1 year into drinking and using. So I'm green, right? I don't know how to roll up weed, but I'm smoking this commercial weed, right? But I soon want to smoke weed on my own. I only could do it when I was with other people. So in my dorm room, I buy this this red roller and add them two yellow zigzags, the thick ones, and I'd stick them together. Now, you can't use this red roller in public. My boys would, hell no, you ain't going to roll with us. So I'm doing it in the room. But in my crew, stick with me. In my crew, there's a guy that could roll joints, one paper, one hand, right? So I'm 18 years old. I go to UCLA, and my goal is still to be the first black president of the United States. By sophomore year, my goal becomes roll a J, one paper, one hand. The alcoholic life seems to be on. Wait a minute, first black president, one paper, one, and I'm off to the races, you guys. And so I'm drinking and I'm using it. And so I go through school, and I'm described in our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in our chapter there as a solution, the paragraph that goes like this. But what about the real alcoholic? I don't think that's me. I think I'm in the paragraph right before that one, the paragraph that talks about the certain hard drinker given a sufficient reason could stop or moderate. When I started suffering some losses in the mid-early 70s, I said, when I grow up and I come up out of this phase I'm in, because I thought I was in a phase, this every day going at it hard in the paint, because I'm going hard, you know, and it's amazing. I had never seen a sea. From junior high school, and my freshman year, I ended up on academic probation. When I had to withdraw from a class my first quarter, it shook me. It shook me, right? But you start lowering standards. This disease takes so much, and it takes it fast. And then I got accustomed to it. I got accustomed to doing what we call skating. I got accustomed to taking what we would call Mickey Mouse. I got accustomed, you know, to taking other people's blue books and turning them in as well. I got accustomed to stuff that I wasn't accustomed to. It may not mean nothing to you, but it means something. That's what it meant to me. And each one of us has our own places we go where this thing, like your sponsor talks about, I slide my dignity across the box. I slide it. But anyway, so, you know, I'm in this phase that I think that I'm in, man. And I think when I grow up, I'm going to slow it down. I never thought I'd quit. I'm just like you, Julie. I ain't never gave no thought to quit until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never gave no thought to quitting. That's crazy. Why would I quit? I'm going to slow it down. I'm going to quit spending all my money every 2 weeks. I'm going to start being on the verge of getting put out the house all the time. I'm going to quit getting fired from these jobs. But hell no. You know, so anyway, so when we graduate from school, my boys, it was six of us in our crew, and my boys start going to grad school, they start starting careers, they start starting families. But I got that thing. I don't know it. It wouldn't have mattered if I knew it, but I don't know it. I got that thing, you guys, and that thing I have won't show up on an X-ray. It don't show up on a CAT scan. It won't show up on an MRI. It will not even show up in your blood alcohol. Now, I know some of you DUI getters are saying, wait a minute, alcohol showed up in my blood alcohol. Yeah, alcohol showed up, but not alcoholism. And I got that thing. More accurately, as Bill describes it, I'm in the grips. It's got me. And it's got me bad. You know, and so I get married in 1980 on a Saturday afternoon in April, and I marry my college sweetheart. I get with her when I'm 19 and she's 18, and I'm quite a catch when I'm 19. I'm not in vogue in high school and in junior high and in high school, ladies, because the pretty boy is the one that's involved. The player is the one that's. I was always the shy guy, you know, and in my crew it would be a bunch of, you know, and I'd always have a couple of guys in my crew that were pretty boys, right? And then we'd be at a club, you know, later on in life we'd be at a club, and I'd be, you know, I'm ear hustling, you know, at the club. I'm trying to see, what does John say to make a girl giggle? Because I don't know how to make a girl giggle. I'm scary, and I'm the shy guy. But so in junior high school and in high school, you guys go for the bad boys. You guys go for the pretty boy. You go for the player, and you go for that. So he's in vogue, and I'm square, and I'm like, but by the time we get college, I'm in vogue. He might make some money. He's going to have a career. He's got a bright future. I'm that guy. You know, I'm the kind of guy that when I got with my college sweetheart, you know, I'm the kind of guy that when you bring me on, you quit messing with that bad boy, Jason. Quit messing with Mike. Why don't you go out with that nice boy, Ralph? Because I'm yes, sir, and I'm yes, ma'am. And I'm respectful. I scared of girls all the way up. I didn't have sex until I was 18 years old. I'm scared of girls, which also translated into it appeared respectful, you know. And so I always had a lot of stuff that appearances made me seem like something. I'm scared, you know. But anyway, so I get with my college sweetheart, man, and by the time of 1980, the wheels are already off. I don't know it. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days I thought alcohol and drugs were working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it, that's all. So in 77 or 78, the wheels are off. I get married in 1980. I have a bachelor party the night before my wedding. I get tore up at the bachelor party. Me and my brothers are still there till 7:30 in the morning. Four of us are with you guys right now. You know, I show up at my wedding, I'm tore up. I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding. Apparently, the stagger was so severe, my then wife-to-be took one look at me coming in there, scratched on vows, say the regular. We get into the ceremony. I get ready to say, I do. I said, I do, and threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. So we traipse off to the honeymoon, and so we're there for 7 days on the honeymoon. Elephant in the room, we don't discuss it, the debacle that took place at the wedding, right? And so we don't talk about that, and we get home from the honeymoon, and we get home, and I get home with a wife, and my wife gets home with a tornado. And guys like me are heartbreakers. We don't mean to be. We ain't trying to be. But I'm in the grips of something that's bigger than me. And it's got me. And if you with me, it's got you too. Probably would have been better, ladies. You know, when you sign up for the bad boy, you know who you signing up for. I'm going to the penitentiary. I'm going to leave some money on his books. I know who it is I'm with. I'm going to play Bonnie to his Clyde. I'm going to be his ride or die. You know, I'm going to be other. But with a guy like me, you don't know it. You don't know it. You think the guy that you fell in love with when you were 18 years old, he's going to pop up, because every now and then he does. I'm described in our book. I build up a structure and I tear it down. I'm the tear down guy, you know. And I kill you slow. I never call you out your name. I've never been that guy. I never put hands. I'm not that guy. But I'm killing you slow. I'm the guy that when you with me, be ready to see the landlord every month, because I'm not going to sing. And you better have a story. When you with me, keep candles. Every utility. I know how every one of them gets cut off. I know how every one of them get reconnected, because they're going to be off all the time. Be ready with a story for your mom or my mom on Thanksgiving or Christmas about why your husband ain't with you again this Thanksgiving. When it's time for the parent-teacher conference, be ready to show up by yourself. If your office has a Christmas party again this Christmas, have an excuse why your husband ain't there. And sometimes it's worse. Be ready for the knock at the door. I come home one day, one night, stick my key in the door. I had a daughter in 1983. And my wife and daughter are sitting here and they're crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat. He got a gun pointing at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide, and it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night, knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. Remember sitting on my back porch one day, 2-year-old daughter coming outside pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping, giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. Alcoholic with no tools of recovery. Did what it took to get what I needed to get. When my wife's purse won too many times, came home the next day, screen door was locked. A note on the screen door, the rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. I'm put out of my house, I'm now my daddy. And over the course of that next year, my 5 brothers got put out of their respective homes. All of us ended up in my mom's house and we almost killed her. In the year of 1985, my mom had a nervous breakdown. She would bring groceries home every single day. Because if she kept food in the refrigerator, these 6 grown leeches that she gave birth to will be selling plates to people in the neighborhood. When I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. She'd bring my daughter over on Saturday afternoon so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I wanted to take her to Disneyland, and I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand, take her to the store and buy her some ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in the fellowship yet. The look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturdays was 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like, I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I disappeared. Sneak back on Sunday night when her mom was coming to get her. Still remember some of those long Sunday nights, sticking my head around the side of my mom's house. And I see those 2 heads in the car and those headlights backing out. And through the tears, I think to myself, there goes my life, backing out of this driveway. Now, I've heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there, and that's not my story. Never scared of dying, scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on the night of October the 10th, 1986, I got miserable enough. I got tired enough. I got directed to my 4th program of recovery. We had a countdown, and a lot of people stood up here for a lot of years. And for the people who stood up with a lot of years, I don't know where our new friend is that had the 7 days. Where you at? Okay. Sitting back there, we call that death row in my home group. But that's all right. That's where I would expect you to be seated. Some meetings, they call that the shoe section. The slippers, the loafers, the sneakers, they call them. But I want to welcome you because that's where I was sitting. I want to welcome you to the worst, best day of your life. You know, I remember. And so when you're sitting back there or when you're sitting up here, Edward, with your mom, you know, this business of grace, it's not something I'm accustomed to. We had all these people that stood up for these years. And this deal of ours, because all of us know it. Make no mistake about it. I'm not here, and I don't label myself. I'm a big book guy. I'm this, you know, big book, 12 steps, you know. Big book ain't what got, it's not what has me sober standing in front of you tonight. The 12 steps is not what has me sober. The big book and the 12 step have connected me to a power that gives me the power to say no thank you. And so when I got here, make no mistake about it, this business of grace, when we come here and we've been here a minute, we recognize it and we call it by name. We don't call it luck and we don't call it coincidence. We sat at graduations and we feel the grace. We know we're sitting in grace, people like us. We give that boy or that girl their first driving lesson and we might pull over to the side and the tears might come because we know for people like us, We might even bury a loved one. And the rest of the family leaves the preparations up, and we sit back and we know it. It's grace. We know it. We go to that preschool program where you got a toddler in school. Some of you parents got little ones, or some of you grandparents, and you sit for 2 hours to see your little 30 seconds, but you know you sitting in grace from where we come from. We've come to expect it. We come to rely on it. We know it by name and we call it. But when I'm new like you, Edward, grace don't look like grace. For most of us who have a last day, grace usually looks like in Jason's case, it might look like handcuffs. Grace may look like being walked out the job with a brown box again. Grace might look like your clothes on the front lawn. Or in my case, on the night of October the 10th of 1986, grace came to me in the form of two youngsters with their pants sagging. Who'd have thought grace would have sagging pants? And they jacked me and they took some money from, and they did it in a weak way. And what ended up happening was I was dodging a black truck the morning of October the 11th, 1986. And I knocked on my mom's back door and what I thought was a lie. And I said, "Mom, if you let me in the house, I promise I'll go up in the program where Ronnie is." My brother Ronnie was in the Harbor Light program, had been there about 80 days. I'm lying. I don't know nothing about it, but I'm lying. But I'm tired. And I knock on the door. Mom is not going for it, not taking my word at all. Pulled out the yellow pages. Yellow pages, remember that? Found the number to the Harbor Light. Called up to the Harbor Light. They located Ronnie. They put him on the phone. I said, "Ronnie, tell Mom they got a bed for me." Ronnie got excited. "Oh, yeah, man, they can get a bed for you." And for years, I call that a flimsy reason. I said, "This lie I told got me with you guys." Turns out I didn't tell a lie. I told my mom, "If you let me in the house, I promise I'll go in the program." She let me in the house, and I went up in the program. And I've been with you ever since. The power of the power. I thought I was the one putting the words in my mouth. Gotta write straight with crooked lines. You know, it really don't matter. I thought I was orchestrating it. I was on the way. And my life has not been mine. It is so amazing to me. One of the guys I like the most, one of my mentors, I got to see him. And now I listen to him a lot. It's Clint H. And he says, you know, Bill Wilson, when you read Bill's story, and I encourage you, when you get into the book with somebody and read Bill's story. Bill is our founder. And you guys probably, you know, I'm probably just preaching to the choir. We usually have newcomers, and you bright and you shiny. And we have used newcomers. And some of the used newcomers know this book better than me. So I don't know why I'm sitting up here like I'm schooling somebody. They probably been, you know. But at any rate, Bill Wilson is our co-founder. And in December of 1934, he found himself in a hospital for the third time that year. He found himself in Towns Hospital, and he saw the same doctor he had been seeing all this time. And when he went into Towns Hospital this December in 1934, he was in a real bad way. He was in such a bad way that the doctor told his old lady, "Get a black dress. Get a black dress. Dude probably ain't coming out of here. And if he does, he's going to have to be locked up. We're probably going to have a wet brain." Bill Wilson said, "I welcome the idea. I feel like that too. I feel like it." And he was in Towns Hospital. He had been visited by a partner of his, one of his running buddies, the month before, Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby had put some ideas in his head that Ebby had got from the Oxford Group, right? So Bill Wilson's in the hospital this December in 1934. Check it out. And so he's in the hospital, and something happened in that hospital that night in 1934. Something amazing. He would later recount it as a white light experience. He said he was laying in the bed thinking and ruminating about what his boy had said, and it was messing with him. And he's talking about God, show yourself, you know. And so Bill, and he said this, a wind came through windows closed, a light came in, and I'm glad it happened to Bill Wilson and it didn't happen to me. I'd have thought it was a PCP flashback, and we're now no Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But it happened to the right guy. And check this out. One of the reasons why we say our program is divinely inspired is because there are things that took place that didn't have no business taking place. There are things that were outside of the scope of the writers when they wrote the book. And there are a lot of coincidences that converged that didn't have no business converging. Starting with Abby Thatcher calling on Bill Wilson when Bill Wilson was drinking. That goes against all the rules about 12-step. Anyway, let's go back to the hospital room. So Bill is in the hospital room, right? Check this out. And Bill had been in this hospital before, and so Dr. Silkworth knows him. He know he got game. Bill is a guy. Bill was stockbroker, you hustler. You know, Bill had a conversation, and so he knew Bill had game. And Bill called Silkworth after this experience. Silkworth wasn't in the room when it happened. Bill called him and described what happened. Silkworth didn't say, "Dude, you crazy." He didn't say, "You hallucinate." Check this out. Apparently, whatever happened to Bill Wilson was so profound that Dr. Silkworth, from the outside looking in, said, "I don't know what happened to you, but you would look good holding on to it." And then the next miraculous thing happened. Bill Wilson wasn't out the hospital yet. Hadn't gone out doing anything, and a thought came. Now, if I had thought I was on the verge of coming up out of this place I was at, this deep, deep, deep pit I was in, if I had thought it was any hope of me coming out, I'd have probably been like, "Man, I'm going to have to get a job. I'm going to have to make some money. I done drug my girl through it. We done moved to anywhere from 22 to 35 in the last year or two. We've been pillar to post," you know, and all those would have been good intentions. But dude said, "Maybe, just maybe, Ralph White's going to show up. I need to find a drunk that might want this." And then he went on to talk about the experience. Bill said, "God's impact," he said, "God's comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound." And most of us, if I took a poll, I would say, how many people feel like God came to them gradually? And that's always been my thought. And Clint said something. I started drinking when I was 18 years old in 1971. And from the time I started going at it in earnest, hard in the pain, hard. Not from the time I was doing it, I did not shut it down. So from 1971 to October the 10th, 1986, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. No matter how great the wish, the necessity, I could not stop. Couldn't put it down. From 1971 to October the 10th, 1986. From October the 11th, 1986 to now, I haven't picked it up. I submit to you that God's impact on me was sudden and profound. I just did not know it at the time. We don't know when we walk through the looking glass. None of us. What a wonderful gift. That was a question about surrender. And surrender is a gift, you guys. I don't bring it about on myself. Anytime I try to consciously say, "I give up, I give," that wears out. You know, I gave up. I give up when I'm in remorse and when I'm broke. I give. I'm done. You know, and on Monday, I'm cool. And on Tuesday, I'm cool. And on Wednesday, I'm cool, but what about Thursday? Bill Wilson calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. I call it, what about Thursday? You know, something happens, and it feels like I changed my mind. But there's something about this thing that's got, but something happened this time that was not of me and was not by me. But God did something with your boy. He surrendered me, and he surrendered me well, and I've been surrendered, and I call it a gift. It's the gift of surrender. It's the gift of desperation. There is one thing, Edward, you got to bring to the table, and it ain't the surrender, but it's the desperation. It is the desire. It is the willingness. Your sponsor, the oldest old-timer in the room, can't nobody give me that. I got to bring the willingness. But God does, and he surrendered me, and I cooperated, you know. And so, but isn't that a wonderful thing, you guys? Impact on me. We don't know when we walk through the looking glass that that's our time, because nobody makes a reservation for recovery. In fact, nobody know that's their day. I didn't know the day before that the next day I'd be in a new world. Isn't that amazing? The day before, you just in your same dreary, dull, Missoum calls it, you know, the jumping off place. Can't live with it. Can't live without it. My life is just going to be like this. The kids ain't going to never want to see me. My husband said, don't come around here like that. He's going up in my purse. And don't nobody trust me. The job say, you can't come back here. The police are after me. I got warrants. I don't have registration, license, or ID. My life is just, I can't come up out of this hole. And that's the day before. And the next day I walk through the looking glass, and I don't even know it. What? God's impact on me was sudden and profound, and my life has not been my own, and I am a guy that does it. Man, I am so grateful for this. You know, we have a brother, and some of the stuff, you guys, that I used to like to take credit for it. You know, but some stuff I can't take credit for. I'm gifted, and if I'm gifted with anything, one of my gifts is the opposite of what Bassoon said. One of my gifts, and me and my sponsor share it, one of my gifts is I fell in love with you guys from the very beginning. I'm just an AA guy. You know, as a kid, I loved books. And I love stories. And you can't find better stories than the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I still love stories. I still love your stories. Keep telling your stories. It's our power. It is our mandate. It is our charge. One drunk sharing with another. That's it. Yeah, people do workshops. I do workshops. People do, you know, so workshops and seminars and the rest of it. But our charge is one drunk sharing with another. We do it like nobody else can. It's what we do. You know, as I started going to meetings, and I fell in love with it. I didn't have a problem with my first step. The second step was a little challenging for me because I grew up in church. And I grew up, you know, and I'm from Baptist church. You know, my mom made us go to church every Sunday morning. I'm like Dr. Bob. I said, when I turn 16 years old, you won't have to worry about Ralph White darkening the doors of anybody else's church. Said it, did it, meant it. Church seemed to me, the stories in church seemed like myths. They seemed like fables. They seem like story to, you know, fairy tales. Steve Lee always says, you know, Daniel and the lion's den might as well be talking about Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, and that was me, you know. And unlike the Catholic experience, which is awe-inspiring and is kind of solemn and is, ooh, but a Baptist experience is high energy, right? And if you're at a Baptist church that's singing, and at a certain point in the proceedings, apparently something runs through the church. It never hit me, but they call it the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost, you know. And I'm 8 years old sitting next to my mom, you know, because they jump up in the church I grew up in. And I'm looking at my mom like, you better not jump up in here and embarrass me, right? I'm eight. I've been self-centered all my life, you know. And so it seemed to me like these were fables and myths and stories, you know. Daniel in the lion's den, Jonah in the whale's belly, parting the Red Sea. What the hell has that got to do with anything? Miss me with that. So I showed up to you guys, the cynic, the scoffer, you know, the skeptic. You gave me another name. You called me agnostic, and you sent me to a chapter. And oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know, I came to you on the negative second step. I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I have been living it. I had come to believe that the gorilla is winning. I had come to believe, and it ain't no problem with me having a power greater than myself. If you knew and you asked that question about the God idea, because I can't find a power greater, I already had a power greater than me. I called it King Alcohol. I need a power greater than it. I needed a power greater than it. And we do not realize what it is we do, you guys. We don't know the power of our fellow. We don't know everything that's going on in these rooms. You know, in my second step, you are as responsible for my second step as me. You are as responsible for my second step as me. The hell are you talking about? You know, because I was open to the idea. I wanted the gorilla off the block. I was willing. I first said, okay. And I like debating and I like arguing. But one of the things that came to me, particularly in our chapter, We Agnostics, which, and in We Agnostics, it says, Ralph, we gonna say why it makes more sense to believe than not to believe. I was selling life insurance for a time, and in that chapter, and in the chapter We Agnostics, they used to have seminars. If you're ever in sales, anybody in who does sales, one of the seminars that they get of salespeople is overcoming objections. And I think our chapter, We Agnostics, should be subtitled Overcoming Objections. I can't find a power greater than, yes, you can. You call it a King Alcohol. You, okay. I don't have the ability to believe in something I can't see that don't make sense to me. How many, what's love got to do with it? How many times you fell in love with somebody and ain't, sense ain't had nothing to do? Well, why you got to go there? You know, and, but this business, you guys, of storytelling and myths and fables, turn out, Ralph, sometimes stumbles into something unknowingly, you know. And so here's the deal. I go to meetings. Here's the power of meetings, you guys, in a couple of areas. Particularly, let's talk about in the second step. So I go to meetings. And every time I go to a meeting, I might hear Erica get up here and she'll say, alcohol had its way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I ain't had a drink in 6 months. Kevin will get up and he'll say, alcohol had its way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I ain't had a drink in 18 months. And then Jason will get up and say, and he'll sing from the same sheet of music. Alcohol had its way with me. I found a power bigger than me. I ain't had a drink for 2 years. And I kept going to meetings, and I kept hearing the refrain, and I kept going to meetings, and I kept hearing the refrain, and I'm not stupid, and I wanted what you guys had. Here's a couple of things that happened with that. You coupled it with your story, because I would think, yeah, my granddaddy had this God thing, but granddaddy's square, he's slow, it's easy for him to believe in God. He needs somebody to tell him, but you were people just like me. And you kept singing that same song. I'm hard-headed, I'm arrogant, but I ain't stupid. Not that many of you guys are lying to me. And you walk me into the second step with the witness testimony. You walk me into that second step, and I wanted it. I wanted it. And it turns out this business of storytelling, you know, after I got on my knees, and I went, and I, because, okay, the next thing to do if I'm going to do this, I got on my knees and I turned myself in and I said, God, do something with your boy. And I was so beat up and I was so tired and I was so devastated and I was so demolished. I'm a real estate agent, and so don't do a remodel. Don't slap no hardwood floors on it and put some paint on it. No, tear it down. Tear it down. Do it from scratch. Bill Wilson calls it roots, grass, new soil. Build it up. The book says something interesting when we talk about our third step. And it's instructive throughout the rest of this process about why not to be so dogmatic, Ralph. You know, the realm of the spirit is broad and clear. You know, and say God don't make hard terms. You know who make hard terms? We do. You know, we do. But God don't make hard terms. The word is quite optional. So I go to God and I say, okay, God. Because what I want is not just, you know, concept or belief. I want relationship. That's the whole deal, you guys. It's too much me between me and the power. You know, when I got on my knees and I said, okay, God, do something with your boy. And you would think, I call this the bait and switch moment in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? because you would think I'm getting ready to say, relieve me of this overpowering thirst for beverage alcohol. Relieve me of this constant desire to get loaded. But something else came out of my mouth. Relieve me of the bondage. When I signed up for that program, whole program, whole deal, too much me between me and the power. Too much me between me and you. Ralph, what are you bound to? You know, bondage yourself, your money, your stuff, your ideas, relieve me of about too much me between me and the power. And so I get on my knees and I say, okay, God, you know, I'm Ralph. I don't know you, but I'd like to. Those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they got some pretty strong references. And they tell me about you. And you come with impeccable references. And I like to get to know you. Do something with me. I like to start celebrating Christmas again. I like to show up for the birthdays. And if it's not too much to ask while I'm down here, I like some of that respect I see some of the men walking around with. And he did something with me. I've never yet seen anybody say, I offer myself to you. And that's the cool thing about the power. When I first got on my knees with a group of people and I said, God, I offer myself to you, I was 16 months sober. I was not a vision for you. I didn't have a lot going on. I didn't have a job. If I walked up to any lady in here and said, baby, I offer myself to you, you'd have been like, dude, keep it moving. But you know... He took me just like that. Unfinished product. Ain't got to come right to get right. Just like that. Still lying, get on your knees. Still tricking, get on your knees. Still stealing, get on your knees. Still hoeing, get on your knees. Took me just like that, in that condition, you know, and did something with me. And it has been, the journey has been remarkable. You know, we got a broad third tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous. And our third tradition is the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And that is a very, very broad umbrella. Most of our members would say that's a wonderful thing. The moment you express a desire, you're on the team. You ain't got to try out. You ain't got to audition. In fact, audition's over. You made it. Check this out. Everybody that's on the team ain't in the game. Put me in the game. Put me in the game. The hell are you talking about, Mr. Speaker? Put me in the game. You know, I want to introduce, and the first way I got in, the first way, and on behalf of all Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to take the liberty. I'm going to say it to you, Mr. 7 Days. Edward, everybody else in here that's new and that's less than a year, I'm going to invite you to come all the way in. Sit all the way down. Do what we do. Come all the way in. I sat with you at dinner. Sit all the way down. Quit doing the hokey pokey. Put your right foot in and take your right foot. Come in. I'm an all-in guy by nature. That's how I'm built. I play ball. I ain't never played ball and expected to sit on the bench. Now, we need bench warmers. We need fans. We need spectators. We even need commentators on the game to make them think. But put me in the goddamn game, you know. Fellas, I don't even do strip clubs because I don't like looking. Put me in. I'm not the spectating kind. Put me in. And as a result of being an all-in guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, let me share something with you. You may not know what you're signing up for. You may not know. My daughter, my oldest daughter, was being born in 1983. I wanted to be a dad. When I told you my first goal was to be the first black president of the United States, that was my big goal. My first earliest goal ever was I'm not going to be like my daddy. When I have a family, I'm going to be a dad that my kids can be proud of. So my firstborn was due to be born 1983. We went to the hospital. It was a false alarm, hit us home. 2 days later, my wife was in the hospital, and they said, get down here, because we're going to induce or do a C-section. I was at the house, and my brother came over, and we took one. I have yet to see Rain White hit this planet, and I wanted to be with my daughter when she hit this earth with everything in me. But I drink no matter what. So when my daughter was being born, I'm drinking. I drink no matter what. When my granddaddy was being buried in 1985, and that was my guy, that was my dude, and I wanted to be at the funeral with everything in me. But again, me and my brother, we took one before the important engagement. I drink no matter what. In 1984, when I was still working in management for a major utility company, and they put me on suspension and 90-day probation, because I had been missing too many days right after payday. Put me on 90-day probation. They said, if you miss one day in these 90 days or call in late, don't bother. The first payday after the warning, I'm in a motel. I get paid on Thursday. Friday morning, I'm still in the motel. I don't want to lose that job. I'm stuck. I drink no matter what. That's our fellowship. That's what we're members of. I came to you guys, and the IRS came after me for $80,000. I don't drink no matter what. I got divorced after 20 years. Marriage blew up, went broke, took my house in front of everybody. I don't drink no matter what. Put countless sponsees in the ground, stood at the funerals. I don't drink no matter what. Got a sponsee, we walk in together. Daughter was killed by a drunk driver, 16 years old. She don't drink no matter what. I'm a member of a fellowship that's full of people who drink no matter what, who do not drink no matter what. How does that happen? I'm a member of the fellowship of men and women who drink no matter what, who do not drink no matter what. Power of God runs deep. And those stories they used to say, I'm going to get out of here, you guys, because I could talk about this power all night long. And them stories, you know, I used to make fun of it. It's just stories in church. It's just stories that they tell. Stumbled upon something. The language of spirituality is storytelling. You don't describe grace. How you give God a face. So what we do is we tell stories. We tell stories. And I never knew the spiritual storytelling was never meant to be literal anyway. It was meant to convey the message. I'm here to tell you, as a result of getting off my knees in that third step, as a result of doing what it is that we do in this uncovering, discovering, discarding process, looking at my resentments and my fears and my sex conduct, I sit with my sponsor and identifying some of the objectionable stuff in me, going to God and say, do something with me, because I can't do nothing with it. Going to see the people, eye to eye, knee to knee, making stuff right. As a result of walking on the sunny side of the street, I'm here to tell you what they used to talk about in church. I've stood in the lion's den many times. They were biting. coming at me. IRS. I don't see no way out of this one. 3 years without a job. 22 years sober. I don't see no way out of this one. Marriage breaking up. Biggest fear. Biggest disappointment. You know, I always wanted to raise my kids in a nuclear family. I remember when I dropped my daughter off, 22 years sober, and I was dropping her off at her godparents. My ex-wife was going to stay with her sister. I was going to stay with my boy, Leon Strange. I didn't have no money. And I sat and I watched her walk up on the porch with her little suitcase. And she looked at me and she was closing the door to her godparents' house. And I stood on that curb and I cried for 45 minutes. How did I fail like this? I'm 22 years sober. It's snapping at my heels. You know, I'm feeling like quitting. I'm feeling like giving up. You know, I've been in the lion's den several times, and I didn't see no way out. But I put my hand in God's hand, and I'm going to share something with you if you're in a dark place. God's grace is always going to be sufficient to meet the need. It's always sufficient. You can grow in the valley. You can grow wherever you plant it. You know, you're going to get, and the thing about that is, you know, I get armed with something that's going to make me uniquely useful. And that's experience, you know, and that's our currency. That's our stock and trade. Getting experience is fine. It's hurting. Having experience is fine. Getting experience hurt. Somebody in here is just getting experience, and God got some big work for you to do. And as a result of walking on the sunny side of the street, you guys, you know, I listened, you know, when Julie was sharing about being walking down the aisle, that 40-year-old daughter, the one who was 2 years old, whose piggy bank I was going in, 40 years old, practicing attorney in the state of California. 12 years ago, when she walked down the aisle, she was accompanied by her dad. She was on my arm. The music was playing. She was shaking, and we were talking, and Rain was saying, "Dad, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm sad about one thing." I said, "What's that, baby?" She said, "This is the last day I'll ever be Rain White, but I'll always be Daddy's girl." Put me in the game. That 29-year-old daughter of mine who graduated from Boston University, it's been 8 years now, you know, I was in the delivery room. When you guys asked the question about proudest moment, I was in the delivery room when that girl hit the earth. I wrote about her when she was in her mama's stomach. I was 40 years old when she was being born. I did not want her to hit this earth. I ain't scared of my thoughts. I ain't scared of none of that. And I wrote about her. I had a resentment. I cannot imagine the world without River White. And River White would not be in this world if it wasn't for you. Who knew? Who knew? Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we doing it right now. I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl getting ready to have mama come back. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we doing it right now. I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come home. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we doing it right now. I get to participate in some man or some woman getting ready to have a hell of a mate in their life. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we doing it right now. Get to participate in some employer that I don't know and could care less about, getting ready to have a hell of an employee into the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? My brothers, it's four of us in this program right now. I have no scientific evidence for this next statement I'm going to make. We were going hard, and we almost killed my mom. She had a nervous breakdown in 1985. Her son started coming to you in 1986. We almost lost her in 1985. Her son started coming to you in 1986. And on February 1st of this year, my mom celebrated 94 years on this earth. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You do the math. You know, so I'm a guy, man. I have been so overpaid since I got here. And one of the hallmarks of spiritual experience, you guys, Ralph's opinion, I'm going to put it right out there. It's two hallmarks. Number one, I believe a person who's really, really tasted and been touched by this, they laugh. They laugh at themselves. I'm dead serious about recovery. I'm seldom serious in recovery. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. I'm scared of people who can't laugh at themselves. And the other hallmark of it, they got to tell somebody. Somebody asked that question about circuit speakers. I don't know a whole lot about that. But when you've known grace like we know Christ, when you sat at the graduation and you know what it's like to miss the graduation, when you open the presents on Christmas and you know what it's like to not be present on Christmas, when you change your mom or dad's diaper and you know what it's like to break their heart, when you sat at the preschool graduation and you know what it's like to not be welcome, when you tasted the grace, you got to talk about it. You got to talk about it. You know, I'm a guy who's always wanted to do something significant, and I'm a guy who's always wanted to do something important. And I can think of nothing more significant, and I can think of nothing more important than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll never hear Ralph White say, "I don't know why I'm sober." I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.